welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. This is your host, Tricia Torrey, every patient's advocate. We've all known this person, the person who constantly gives advice, but then make choices that don't exactly line up, more like the do as I say, but not as I do type of person. Well, recently, the Wall Street Journal addressed this question about doctors wanting to know how patients are influenced by their doctor's health habits. So, for example, suppose you are quite overweight, or your quite overweight physician suggests you lose weight, or the one whose white coat smells of cigarette smoke implores you to give up smoking. Well, you get the drift. So who's an expert to bring in to discuss this question? We've asked Upstate's Dr. Thomas Welsh, Chair of Pediatrics, also known as Adirondack, a man of many interests and exercises. And I can tell you that because he's sitting right across from the microphone from me. Not one extra pound on his very lean and muscular frame. Good morning, Dr. Welsh.
Good morning.
And a lot of people see you on TV when you're interviewed, don't they? They know that you are a very healthy looking man.
I try to set a good example, right?
Well, and you know, that's actually the question from this report in the Wall Street Journal. It seems like they were studying physicians' habits and how that might influence their patients. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that most physicians hopefully recognize that many of the chronic diseases we deal with these days are lifestyle diseases. You mentioned weight and smoking, and I would add blood pressure to that as well. So I think that physicians hopefully realize that in their own lives, the lifestyle choices that they make may well be more important to their long-term health than what they do in terms of seeing physicians themselves.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. I think a couple of different ways about this. For instance, yes, they would almost have to be role models. It's tough to tell a patient to quit smoking if you smell like cigarette smoke yourself. But some of these things are not so easily observed. I can't observe what my doctor's blood pressure is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned a very interesting point. You can't observe what your doctor's blood pressure is, but you may know what he or she eats. And there's an increasing body of evidence today that the simple initiative of lowering the sodium content in our diet would do far more to take care of blood pressure on a population-based basis than a lot of physician visits and medications. In fact, altering the salt content of the diet may be the single most important public health initiative that we can do over the next few years.
Well, there you go. And that's actually one of the things we would kind of address in the advice, what should we do as patients. But I want to go back to this study because there were some interesting observations. And you're someone who's working with physicians every day. I'm somebody who's talking to them, perhaps. Our listeners are people who have appointments with them. And so let's look at that for a moment. There was a physician's health study of 19,000 physicians. It showed that 40% of them were overweight and 23% were considered obese. And the article considered that physicians were less likely, but the numbers were actually almost parallel for the number of people who considered themselves healthy. So does this tell us that people are kind of following in the footsteps of their physicians, or at least what they observe?
Well, I think what it may say is that what we all know, that once one gets to a situation of having a weight problem, dealing with that is a very, very difficult thing to do.
Absolutely is. And, you know, one of the things they talked about was the fact that the triggers would be the same for overweight. And I can really relate to these. High stress, a very crowded calendar, too many things on my to-do list, not enough hours, not enough sleep. And we have to think that that's true for a lot of physicians.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing to remember is that overweight and obesity is not something that happens overnight.
True.
It's something that develops very gradually. So I would be very interested, and I haven't seen this information, but I'd be very interested in seeing about physicians in training, medical students. Mm. I think, you know, by the time one gets to be 40, 50, 60 years old, losing a significant amount of weight, it's not impossible, but it certainly is a challenge.
Yeah.
So I would like to think that young health professionals may be a little more conscious of the possibility of winding up overweight and may pay a little more attention to this.
Well, it was also interesting because they looked at smoking, and this is where there was a huge difference. In the population of 19,000 physicians, only 2 to 4% of them smoke, whereas it's 24% of the general population. So I have to think that those physicians are at least listening to the research out there themselves, but they're having a little trouble translating that to their patients.
Absolutely. Smoking is almost a special case in terms of health behavior. You know, you certainly hear all of the adverse consequences of smoking in the media, but physicians who see that directly day in, day out, may be a lot more conscious of it. I will say, though, that smoking is incredibly addictive, and I can speak from somewhat personal experience. My son, who is a physician, started smoking in high school and had an extraordinarily difficult time stopping, even once he became a physician and knew full well all the difficulties of it. So, you know, even more than obesity, smoking is a habit that once established is extraordinarily difficult to stop. And I think that many physicians may recognize that and not get into it in the first place.
And yeah, and I think that's probably a really good point, because if you're going to become a physician, you generally know that by the time, you know, you're thinking about it in high school, and you generally know it by the time you're in college. And that's when a lot of these young people are making those choices. I think you're probably right. But I also think that physicians, and you tell me again, you're the person with this experience, you're exposed to so much more information about consequences. I mean, you're reading the journals. You're not just picking up whatever the headline is in the newspaper. And when it's in the newspaper or online or in a magazine, I, as a consumer, can choose to ignore to read things. But you, as a professional, need to be up on whatever the professional information is. And so do you think that exposure to that additional information is something that helps doctors make those choices?
Well, I think certainly exposure to professional information does that, but indeed, one's day-to-day practice reinforces it as well. Mm-hmm. When I see a child refer to me for high blood pressure, which is one of the types of problems that I treat in my professional life, before I walk in the door, I can almost always predict that the child that I'm about to see because of high blood pressure will either be overweight or will have a significant exposure to fast food.
Wow, there you go.
So, you know, I can read about it, but simply my day-to-day practice. And I'm sure my internist colleagues, when they're seeing people with lung cancer, with significant coronary artery disease, with strokes, recognize that certainly not all of them, but the bulk of these individuals will have some sort of a smoking history.
Yeah, in which case, once again, we go back to that whole lifestyle thing. One of the questions that was raised in this article also was, would doctors who have also developed these habits that are not healthy habits, would they also have trouble making recommendations to their patients? I mean, patients are observing one thing, but if the overweight doctor tells me I need to lose a little bit of weight, that's not going to have the same effect on me, perhaps, as the doctor who, like you, is lean and in good shape. Is there an influence there?
Well, I don't know. It'd be hard to speculate on it. I think that it actually might not be so much that one would not take what the physician said seriously, but might use the fact that his or her physician was overweight as an excuse. In other words, you know, here's a physician who recognizes this is a problem, and he or she isn't able to take care of it. Guess I can't either.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say that as somebody who's battled her weight all of her life, I also look at it as, you know, we think it's so simple, quote unquote, I say that with quotes, we think it's so simple as to say lose weight, and we know there's got to be something else going on. Same with smoking. You're talking about the addictive quality, and we are learning now that foods have been built, processed foods have been built to be more addictive than they might have been. There is a lot more research that needs to be done along those lines. Well, one of the other shifts in the article, which I found fascinating, was that they said that female physicians are far more likely to be taking hormone replacement therapy than the general population, and they're more likely to have mammograms than the general population. So the hormone replacement therapy, that's kind of anti what we've read in the literature about hormone replacement therapy. Do you have an explanation for that?
I don't. I was really surprised to see that myself. And all I can say is that there may be some female physicians who weigh the symptoms of menopause, including the symptoms or findings related to bones, against the risk and choose to take that risk. Certainly, my own reading of the medical literature would suggest that that's a mistake, but obviously there are female physicians who are obviously invested in making the right choice,
sure,
who choose to do that. And obviously that's not something like smoking or obesity that we can say is an addiction. That's a clear choice that someone who presumably was informed made.
Absolutely. And I do find that fascinating. I would love to interview some of those doctors and find out what was behind their choices. But I also, I found it interesting. It said they were far more likely to have mammograms. I don't recall that the article said anything about the PSA tests for the male doctors, but those are preventive kinds of tests. And so it's good to know that my doctor thinks they're important enough for my doctor to have too. But in general, we find that there are really question marks about a lot of the tests that are being given now. PSAs, that's a big question mark.
Right. Well, without getting into the, I'm certainly not in a position as a pediatrician to make recommendations on things such as PSAs, but I will say that many of the screening recommendations that are made are not necessarily made after a dispassionate evaluation of evidence, but may be made by specific advocacy organizations. And indeed, if one followed every screening recommendation that is made for healthy people in the United States, one could be going to a physician or a laboratory once a week.
All the time.
So I think that the Institute of Medicine and the Advisory Council of the United States Public Health Service has actually looked very carefully into screening recommendations. And if you read their reports, you'll see that the number of conditions for which screening routinely is recommended is much, much narrower than that which comes from many specialty societies.
Yeah, and you know, there are some politics involved in all of this as well, too. I know we had a report just a couple of months ago about when women should be getting mammograms, and the report said that starting at the age 50, and then, of course, every one of the groups you're talking about came out saying, oh, no, 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 after the age of 40, and then they brought out people who were diagnosed at that younger age, and certainly you'd want to make sure that you would catch them if they have a family history in particular, but it's still kind of more of a political football than a health decision, it seems.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, all one needs to do is look at the way in which the debate over healthcare reform became almost caricatured during the year or so that it was discussed, and recommendations as benign as evidence-based medicine, which is what we all like to practice, became caricatured as death panels.
Yes,
so
yes.
I think it's very difficult for physicians to make an attempt to educate folks about the evidence basis for recommendations when they may need to be, or they may wind up finding themselves being shouted down by advocacy groups.
Yeah, yeah. We've only got about another minute, but I wanted to ask you, how does all this translate to pediatrics? So I look at the young mother, parents who've just given birth, they've got a new baby, and I would say to you as a pediatrician, all right, now, do you have your baby in there every month for a checkup? Is there a reason why you would do that and therefore other parents should do it as well?
Certainly the most important intervention that's done in children is immunization. And in the first couple years of life, the bulk of visits to a pediatrician or family physician are actually for immunization.
And, you know, I think back to when I had babies, and it seemed to me like I was at the pediatrician's office all the time. And sometimes they were checkups. Sometimes they were because the baby wasn't feeling well. But I have to wonder then, you do believe then that they should be at the doctor's office doing that as frequently as they do?
Oh, absolutely. But I would just stress that the important part of that visit is, first of all, the immunization, and secondly, the counseling with the pediatrician or the family physician, what to expect in the next couple of months,
sure,
dietary advice, that sort of thing. Once you've listened to a child's heart carefully in the first few weeks of life, listening while most pediatricians do it, mm-hmm, you're unlikely to pick up something again.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting question anyway, and I do think it's important that you're, as a physician, in a position to model behavior. And it is, you know, it's a question for patients to be talking to their doctors about recommendations that are being made. Thank you very much, Dr. Welsh, for coming by this morning. Interesting conversation. I hope our listeners give it some thought.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we do need to take a break. Please do stay with us. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air on 570 WSYR.